If I felt that the person was high and I didn't want to terminate him and I was in that rigid place, then I wouldn't catch him. I'd go in and talk to them and say, today I'm not catching you. I would. I'd tell them I could catch you, but today I'm not going to catch you. Because if I catch you, I've got to terminate you, and I don't want to terminate you. But I don't know how many more times I can not catch you. Well, that doesn't make any difference whether they're your peers or not. You're still the one that... There's got to be in every situation somebody that runs the place. These are not democratic operations. And you just go on the idea. So you tell them that when you first come in, that we're not going to go on tests, we're not going to go on breaths, we're not going to go on all these silly things. If I think you're high, you're high. That's what it's going to be. You're going to have to prove it to me. And then they'll see how you act and how you behave. And they'll see that you catch people sometimes, you don't catch other people, and they'll get the picture. And if you do this wisely, they'll begin to behave better. That's all. It's a question of using your power wisely. This is a benevolent despot, the people that run this place, which is, in essence, the world's greatest form of government. The only problem is we never can count on despots to be benevolent in political things. But here there are a lot of benevolent despots running places. Now, you do it because it's the best thing to do. And it's not that it's the best thing. It's the best thing you got going for you. And then you just do it, that's all. Well, if I'm so stupid that I blow the whole house, I blow it, that's all. I mean, I'm going to have some contact with reality. If I'm doing a good job, the local policemen are going to be very good to me because I'm taking a lot off their back. And if I'm doing a lousy job, then I'm not going to be around very long anyway. The police aren't against a drug counselor if they feel he's helping some addicts on the street. It's going to make their life simpler. Police aren't looking for misery either, you know. They're not looking for. They'd like it if there was less crime. They'd be fine with them. But again, the effectiveness of my job, and we're talking about very subtle things on how to make this job effective. But we're not dealing with an easy problem. And if I run an absolutely rigid place, bust everybody that I suspect, or if I have to get into testing, my house is gone. I mean, if every time I'm testing, because they'll fiddle their way around these tests 65,000 times. And the labs, you know, in California, did you read about what they're doing in California? They were just sending back positives on the known addicts, that's all. The lab was pocketing the money. The urine test, 60,000 tests they lied about and took the money. If they were known addicts, they sent back pluses. And if they weren't, they sent back minuses, that's all. And so they found that out. So the whole methadone program, in terms of testing, was blown. I mean, you can't. You're not dealing with honest people anywhere. People are ripping you off right and left. Because they rationalize they're only addicts anyway. See, that's the rationalization. Addicts are lower than the lowest, so they can do anything. Your best bet is to go on your own instincts and run your place that way and depend very little upon these concrete indicators, which are very unconcrete. You go to the average hospital, and you're the average patient, like in the hospital across the street or wherever the hospital is, 25% of all the test results are wrong. I mean, that's just the way it is, that's all. Well, people are getting paid a few bucks. A girl, the technician, had trouble with her boyfriend that night, so she calls all the hemoglobins 10.5, you know, and that's the way it is. They looked about that way. I mean, no, we deal with the facts of life. It's clinical judgment that's going to make us survive. What I wanted to do this morning is discuss this concept of positive addiction, not only because it's interesting, which I think it is, but I think also it's got some application to a lot of the things that I've been talking about over the past several years. I became interested in the whole concept of addiction recently, and yesterday I described what I termed was negative addictions. just alcoholic or drug taker or gambler or people who just extravagantly overeat to the point where they could be considered addicted to food. And I said that these people do that because the process of the addiction, for reasons which are not understood, because only certain things will do this, drugs, alcohol, gambling, maybe food, I think food too, actually take away the pain that's associated with the failure to find love and worth. For some reason, these things and not other things relieve this pain. And not only that, they give you pleasure besides. And I talked about the fact that the pleasure isn't an active pleasure. An active pleasure is the kind of pleasure where you can tie what you're doing, some activity, to the fact that it feels good. It can be a relatively passive activity, even like watching a picture show or reading a book, but still you're actually doing something tangible and specific. Whatever it is, achieving something, finding someone to love, all these things, you know where the pleasure comes from. This is not the same thing as the pleasure associated with what an addict feels or an alcoholic feels. He doesn't need anyone to enjoy his pleasure. In fact, ordinarily prefers that there be nobody around. The second thing is that he doesn't need to do anything to enjoy his pleasure except the thing that he does, which is his particular addicting activity. Now, you might say gambling is kind of an active pleasure, but I'll try to explain that it's probably not in the sense of what I previously described. Now, certainly when you get into the more typical addictions and the more common ones like drugs, then except for taking the drug, the person need do nothing else. Now, those are negative addictions, and why I call them negative, and I'll explain that even further today, is because once you get hooked into your addiction, then you have no particular desire to struggle again for love and worth. Love and worth, all the things that you get from loving and doing worthwhile things with your life and fun things with your life, these things take a certain amount of activity and everything else that the addict, he's given up on this actually. What I described yesterday, he's already given up on love and worth, and he hurts because he doesn't have them. But then when he gets involved with his addiction, he gets rid of that pain and he feels good, but he no longer struggles for them because why should he? It doesn't make any sense. That's a faraway thing, to find worth, to find love. That might take him weeks or months or days or whatever it is. It takes him only literally moments to find the pleasure inherent within his addiction. So when you're dealing with an addict, like Richard played here yesterday, and he played very classically, the addict was saying, he said, "Well, you haven't asked me about my problem." Richard essentially said that. And I said, "All right, what is your problem?" And he said, "Well," he said, "my wife, and my girlfriend." In other words, he was talking about active seeking of love and pleasure in the world, but it wasn't working out. And that was his problem, and he was then starting to use narcotics again, and he was implying that if it weren't for this problem, he wouldn't use narcotics. And see, that's probably accurate. What he's saying is, I can't handle the hassle. And with narcotics, there is no hassle. It's a sure thing, an absolute sure thing. And so what he was trying to say, don't you understand that? Well, narcotics are illegal and all kinds of trouble, and I'm trying to get him to quit them. But the point is, from his standpoint, quitting them is foolish. And that's why it makes it so difficult for people to deal with narcotics addicts, because it is foolish from their standpoint. They say, I get my pleasure all by myself. I hurt no one. I involve no one in this thing. If I could get my narcotics and go to my room, take them, and enjoy myself all by myself, why in the world should this be illegal? Well, it's illegal. I didn't make it illegal, but it is, that's all. We've decided that people shouldn't do that. And that's what it amounts to. And so then we hassle these people. And of course, the more we hassle them to find love and worth, the more they get inclined to say that's just further hassle. And so the thing snowballs in the wrong direction. But of course, narcotics are a very serious problem if you look at the thing overall from a social standpoint, that the people that use narcotics generally resign themselves to a life only of narcotics, only of addiction, whatever their addiction is. And so we wouldn't want to see that in a friend, and we wouldn't want to see it in a relative, because we say, why, they're only going to get a very small portion of life. But to make the further step of making it illegal, well, that creates other complications. And I'm not against making it illegal. I'm not particularly for it. I mean, that's the way it is. I'm not going to change that. But I think we have to understand that when you make something illegal, that doesn't make people not want to do it. It just makes it illegal. That's all it does. The desire for the narcotic is still there. If we could make loneliness and worthlessness illegal and enforce that law, then there wouldn't be any narcotics use. It would be so small, it wouldn't make any difference. But we haven't been able to make loneliness and worthlessness illegal. And we really don't punish a person for being lonely or worthless. I mean, whatever his life is, that's his punishment. We punish him when he tries to do certain things about it. In other words, you can do some things about it, not other things. When he tries to do something about it which is addicting, then he'll get punished on top of it. Well, that's what negative addiction is. Now, if that's what negative addiction is, then it occurred to me, and very faintly throughout the years, that maybe there's another side of the coin, but it never registered much upon me. The other side of the coin being, if this is negative addiction, which is bad, then maybe there's such a thing as positive addiction, which is good. But, I mean, I have this kind of a thinking. I always think there's kind of another side of a story, but I never thought much about it until about a year and a half ago when I was reading a book, just an ordinary book that we took on vacation with us, called The Boys of Summer, a book about baseball players, the Brooklyn Dodgers and the great teams of 52, and what happened to them later on. And Roger Kahn, the author, interviewed them 20 years after they won the pennant. And we interviewed a man named Shuba that played on the team, a man named George Shuba. And he was a good ball player, not one of the great ball players, perhaps, but a very good one. Any major league ball player is a good ball player. And he had hit pretty well. And when Roger Kahn interviewed him, he didn't know him that well, but he knew him fairly well, just to open the conversation back in 1972 when he was doing the Shuba part of the book. He said, "George, one thing about you, you always had a great natural swing. A nice, smooth swing." And George laughed, and he said, "Let me tell you about my natural swing." And he said, "When I was a kid, 16, in Youngstown, Ohio, thinking about what I should do with my life, I decided I'd like to be a ball player, major league player. Everyone in my family always worked in the steel mills, and it didn't appeal to me. And I was a good athlete, and I thought maybe I could make the majors." Well, a lot of kids decide to be a major league ball player, but very, very few ever make the majors. And he said to himself, had some persistence, he said, "Any major league ball player can usually field. That's not the hang-up. The hang-up is they can't hit. Athletes tell me that hitting major league pitching is the single most difficult athletic feat that there is. Because even of those that make the majors, only a very few can hit. I mean, just a very, very tiny percentage of them can actually hit the ball well, consistently." So Shuba decided he didn't know how to learn to be a hitter, but he thought all the good hitters have great swings. And so at 16 years of age, I mean a very, very young age to have such perseverance, he decided he would improve his swing, if nothing else, which he could do by himself. So he took a piece of string and hung it from the rafter in his basement. And the string was knotted, like just to show him where the strike zone was across his chest. And then he took a heavy bat, a bat that was weighted with lead, so so it would be harder to swing, and he could build up his arms. And he swung the bat at the string, starting at age 16 and continuing throughout his major league career until almost 37, 38 years of age. He swung the bat at the string 600 times every day, which is a lot of times. He only skipped it on days he played in a major league game, off days, minor league, summers, winters, whenever. He swung it regularly 600 times. When I read that over, not being a disciplined person along those lines myself, and thinking of myself at 16 years of age, could have I even begun to do anything like that? I was really impressed by this. I said, wow, how in the world did he do it? I mean, I could see perhaps going out if he had a friend pitch to him 600 balls or something like that, which is more or less related to hitting a ball. But just by yourself in the basement swinging a bat at a hunk of string, it seems to me would take an inordinate amount of self-discipline. And I said, how would a 16-year-old have this much discipline? Well, I'm sure that some do. The world is full of highly disciplined people. You read about them, guys that play the piano 8 hours a day and things like that. But it still struck me as unusual. And I thought about it, and I said to myself, because even playing the piano, that's a direct thing. If you practice, that's it. You play the piano. But he was swinging a bat. That wasn't hitting the ball. I said to myself, what happened to Shub, I thought, just idly running this through my head, as I was just kind of laughing to myself, I said, he must have become addicted to this. He must have become addicted to swinging a bat, a hunk of string. Because I said, otherwise, I don't think he could have done it. And to some extent, I think that that's correct. I don't think he was highly addicted to it, but I think there was a process of addiction there. And by that I mean, very simply, that if he didn't swing the bat once he got started doing it on some kind of a regular basis, if he didn't swing the bat, it hurt. Now, it might not have been excruciating like recovering from being taken heroin from you or something like that, but it hurt enough so that it was just as easy to go swing the bat the 600 times and get rid of the pain and also justify that you were doing something worthwhile and all that kind of thing. And Shuba describes that he did have some discomfort, some feeling he ought to be doing it, some feeling that his life wasn't quite complete without it once he started it, which is kind of the minimal beginning processes of an addiction, this feeling of annoying displeasure, this feeling of pain if you don't do it. Well, when I thought about that and started thinking through this, I started thinking along this area of addiction, and I considered that, well, this might be a positive addiction. Positive addiction is different from a negative addiction. A positive addiction, if you can stick to it, it does you good. Instead of a negative addiction, the more you stick to it, the more it gets you separated from love and worth. A positive addiction, the more you stick to it, the more it perhaps ties you to at least worth. I couldn't see where swinging a bat would get you much love, but it would tie at least to worth anyway. So I began to think then about some other just friends of mine, the two sons of a friend of mine who I'd known for many years. And this friend of mine came to me about 10 years before, around maybe 1961 or something like that. And he said, I'm worried about my boys. And I says, what about? He says, well, they're good boys, but they're just not getting along well. They're kind of in college and out of college and not settling down. And the kind of a thing that was going on with many young people in the 60s, and perhaps to some extent today, just kind of not finding themselves. And he was worried that maybe they were experimenting with some drugs. I mean, it was a pretty straight household there, and even the idea that they might have been using a little marijuana was very upsetting to him. I don't know whether they use drugs or not. It's immaterial to me. But he was worried about it. He said, what should I do? Well, what do you tell a friend? You know, I said, everything will be all right. What else can you say? You know, they were good boys, and he was a good father, and there was a good marriage, good mother and father in the home, and I felt, you know, things would work out. They usually do. And like I say, I know what else to say anyway. And so I said, everything will be fine. And he said, good, okay, fine. You know, he was happy to hear that, and things did work out well as far as that goes. But about a month or two later, I don't remember, a period of time later, he came to me and he said, you know, the boys are involved in something, and I don't know a thing about it. What do you know about it? And I said, what is it? He says, well, he said they met a man called the Maharishi, and they've started to meditate. And he says, you know anything about meditation? I said, don't know a thing about it. I says, what do they do? And he says, well, every day they take 20 minutes off in the morning and 20 minutes off in the afternoon, and they meditate. I said, well, what do they do? He said, well, they just sit and meditate. He says, he doesn't know what they do. They just go to a room quietly, and 20 minutes later they come out and they say they finished meditating. I says, well, hell, I says, it can't hurt anybody. I said, I can't see or, you know, I don't think they'll ever make this process illegal. And he says, you know, he says, it's helping them. He said, they're kind of buckling down. They're getting their teeth into their schoolwork. They seem to just be so much better than they were. He said, could it be the meditation? I says, well, sure, probably is. That's the only thing that's changed. He says, yeah. He says, and Jesus, they believe in it. They just thoroughly sold on the value of meditation. And I said, well, that's great. And then I implied, you're doing some thinking, you know, not knowing much about it. I said, well, it's any kind of a self-disciplined activity is bound to do you good, which I believe it will. I mean, but I think there's more to it than that. But I said, encourage it, which he did. In fact, he even started to do it for a while later on, but he couldn't quite get into it. But anyway, they did it. And they're both still meditating, and they both went to work for the Maharishi. And one of them is now, I don't know if you've heard, but the meditators bought Parsons College in Iowa, and they have the Maharishi International University, MIU. And one of the boys is the vice president of the university. And it's a very good place. I mean, they're very straight people. You know, no drugs, no fussing around, no, not even long hair. They don't even allow that. The Maharishi wears it long, but nobody else allowed to. So, so anyway, I get to thinking, you know, how do you meditate 20 minutes twice a day? That's why I got these meditators who've helped me out here a little bit. But I couldn't meditate on a regular basis. I'm not, like I say, this thing I couldn't do. Oh, well, I could do it, I suppose, but I wouldn't do it. But people do it. I mean, literally hundreds of thousands of people are involved in transcendental meditation, which is only one form, and goodness knows there's lots of other forms of meditation. And it seems to do them good. And I began to think, well, what is this? What's going on here? And then I began to think a lot more about it, and I came to some conclusions. Well, let me tell you, I began to think about the whole concept of positive addiction. I developed a theory. I said a positive addiction is like a negative addiction in many respects, which is it's something you choose to do. Same as a negative addiction, you choose to do it. It's something you do on a regular basis. It's something that you can do by yourself. Obviously, again, essentially the same as a negative addiction. But it's something that doesn't give you much pleasure, I thought. It's something that, like, I couldn't see how you get your kick swinging a bat or meditating or anything like that. I said, it must be something that's difficult to do, but has a payoff later, versus a negative addiction, which is something easy and pleasurable, but which hurts you. In other words, one is it feels lousy, but does you good, and one feels good and does you lousy, if you understand kind of what I mean here. So that seemed nice and even and was kind of a good theory. And so I wrote up a little questionnaire similar to this one that I asked here, but just generally and about positive addiction, and started talking a little bit about it kind of after a talk, and got people to fill out the questionnaire and talk to people. And I was talking in Irvine, California, a little city south Los Angeles, and a fellow came up to me after the talk and said, I am definitely a positive addict. I said, well, what do you got? You know, and he said, well, he said, and he was dressed in monk's robes. I mean, he was a beautifully dressed, and he was a beautiful man. He looked like Robin Hood, just exactly like Robin Hood, with that beard and a little mustache, just like Errol Flynn. And, I mean, I never saw Robin Hood, but I saw Errol Flynn, you know. I mean, so, and he had a big silver chain around his waist, you know, looked like it was taken from the battleship Missouri, a great big heavy chain, and 5-pound silver cross hanger on his neck. He was a prosperous looking monk. And he said, well, he said, I used to be an alcoholic. I said, yeah. He said, I was really a down in the bottom of the barrel alcoholic, he said. And one day I got myself together, and I says, "What's happening to your life?" This was a young man. It must have been a very young alcoholic. And he said, "Your life is going down the barrel." I said, "I got to stop drinking. I got to get something going," he said. So I decided I would chant. Every day, I would chant the Psalms. And I says, "What do you mean by chant?" Because I'm not much for chanting. And he says, "Well, you just chant them, you know, you chant away." And I said, "Well, how long would you chant the Psalms?" He said, "An hour a day." He said, an hour on the clock. I said, "How long have you been doing?" He says, "Oh, 4 or 5 years. I said, "Well, what happened?" He says, "Well, I stopped drinking. Got my life organized. I wanted to start a monastery, started my own monastery. I got a bunch of monks working for me. And he says, things are going good." Well, then I asked him another question. I says, "Do you enjoy the chanting?" "Oh," he said, "I hate it." And so, see, that further verified in my mind this assumption that a positive addiction is something you don't like doing, but it does you good. And everything was all set, and I had it all figured out, and I started looking for more positive addicts, but it didn't work that way. I made a serious error. But that's way too simple. So I was talking further about it around a year ago May in Toronto. Just about last May in Toronto. And I developed this time a lot of different positive addicts and things like that. And the fellow in Toronto raised his hand. He said, "I'm an addict." And I said, "What do you do?" And by this time, I discovered this group of people. He said, "I run." In this country and in Canada, there are a lot of people that run. You see them out in the morning, usually, if you get up that early. They're out there running. Usually run by themselves and just run around for an hour or so, and then they run home, and that's it for the day. And they firmly believe in it, and furthermore, those that run on any kind of a regular basis are addicted to it. It's one of the most addicting things that you can get involved in if you get addicted. And so this runner was telling me, and I said, "Well, tell me about your addiction." He says, "Well," he said, "there's only one thing with running." He said, "It's dangerous." I said, "How could running around Toronto at 6 o'clock in the morning be dangerous? You know, I mean, you know, what's the danger involved here? You know, it's not as bad a city or anything like that." He says, "Well," he said, "I almost got run over by cars on several occasions." He said, "I got to watch myself very carefully." I says, "Well," I said, "you know, all you got to do to avoid getting run over by a car is to watch where the hell you're going." I said, "That's not a dangerous thing." He says, "Well," he said, "but it's hard to watch where you're going." I says, "Why?" I said, "Are you blind?" He says, "No, you don't understand." Then he explained to me something which gave me a considerable key into this thing. He said, "When I run," he said, "I kind of go into a trance. And I really don't know completely where I am. I'm only mildly aware of my surroundings. I'm just in some kind of a trance-like state." And I said, "Describe it a little more." He said, "Well," he said, my brain, it kind of just spins out. It just kind of goes away, and my body is running along there, and my brain's doing something else." And he said, "It's very, very enjoyable." And so I thought to myself, because I see them in my neighborhood, and I get to go to the airport early, those runners out there with their faces contorted in pain running along, what the hell's making them run? Well, evidently there's another component to this thing, because when I talked at great length to the meditator, my friend that's the vice president of the Maharishi University, he said to me, "You've got an interesting theory, and probably meditation is an addiction." He said, "But," he said, "it is not painful." He said, "Meditation is pleasurable." He said, "It can very well be pleasurable from the first time you do it, and gets increasingly pleasurable as you do it." And then as I talked to him, what he described that goes on in the head of a meditator is very, very similar to what goes on in the head of a man running who's really into running, who is addicted to running. That both people spin out, transcend, their mind goes free, whatever words you want it. And this state of your mind spinning free is extremely enjoyable. But it's not an active pleasure. The running may be active, but what the mind is doing is a passive kind of a thing. It's not doing anything. It's almost being left by itself, and it's almost as if you can leave your mind by itself, your mind enjoys being left alone. And you experience this as pleasure, actually as quite an intense pleasure. A runner writing in an English newspaper, someone sent me the clipping, a long distance runner, a marathon runner who runs 26 miles every day. He says, "I get excited when I lace on my running shoes." He said, "And as soon as I step into my run, I start to spin out." He said, "I start to transcend." And he said, "There's parts of my run that I would describe what's going on in my head is almost ecstatic." He said the 3 hours, the 2.5 hours, whatever it takes him to run the 26 miles, go by almost as if nothing. I come home and I sometimes notice my feet are bloody because it's hard on your feet to run that far, and I haven't even noticed it. I've just, all of a sudden, the run's over and the state is over. Now, I have lots of different stories from a lot of different people. I am collecting data on two large groups, runners. I literally have thousands of letters from runners, and I'm collating all that data. And now I'm starting to get some data on meditators. Now, everyone that runs and everyone that meditates and exercises or does yogi or does a whole bunch of other things doesn't necessarily reach what I call the PA state. And the positive addiction state is this state of mind where your mind separates literally from your body, where your mind is left alone by itself. One runner describes it in his letter to me. "It's as if my mind leaves my body and floats along beside my body as my body is running, and occasionally observes this poor fool killing himself out there and says, 'It's just so pleasant just to be floating along here beside.' And he said, 'My mind is off doing its thing.' He said, 'It's so enjoyable that I stay with my mind, you know, and leave my body be. It's kind of difficult, but I'm beginning to understand what they're talking about." Well, how does this help you? What does this do for you? Because I also have data, quite conclusive data, that people who run or people that meditate do gain strength. Now, yesterday we talked about strength through the regular way of gaining it. The regular way is through love and worth. That requires other people. If you're a positive addict, you gain strength on your own. You don't need any other people. You can do it by yourself. Positive addicts describe an increase in self-confidence, among other things, an increase in their ability to live their lives effectively. An increase in their ability to control habits like smoking and drinking and overeating and things like that. Well, along with this, in the spring I also read an article in Psychology Today, and this tied it up a little more. Psychology Today had an article by a Purdue professor of physical education where they took some sedentary people on the Purdue campus and talked them in, I don't know how many of them, into involving themselves in a 3-month exercise program to see if they could benefit these people through exercise. They had a series of exercises, among which was running. They did it on a daily basis. And they tested them before and after physically, which I don't know the results of that test because Psychology didn't report it, but they tested them psychologically also and found that they had an increase in 3 psychological factors, one of which is quite predictable by anybody. The other 2 are not too predictable. One Psychology Today made a guess on. The other one Psychology Today was totally puzzled by, the people who wrote the article. However, if you think of positive addiction, they're all quite predictable. The first factor was a marked increase in self-confidence, which everyone reported. The second factor was a marked increase in imagination. They tested them for imagination, and on an imagination scale, they had a marked significant increase. The third factor was a marked increase in guilt. They felt more guilty. And Psychology Today could not explain that one at all. But it's obviously that that's tied to addiction. They didn't get addicted. I wrote to the professor, and none of them became addicted in the 3-month period. But they came close. They had periods, I'm sure, where their minds spun out for brief periods, and they experienced this PA state of mind. And once you experience that pleasure, then if you don't re-experience it, you begin to feel as an addict does, discomfort, and some of the very common discomfort that is reported is guilt. And so none of them did it long enough to get it. All they got it, they got enough to get a little more confidence, a little more imagination, and a little more miserable because they quit, which is unfortunate, but that's just the way it is. How long does it take to become addicted? Well, the meditators claim you can get addicted right away. I doubt it myself. I think it takes a while. But it evidently, if you're able to do it, and I don't know what criterion allows you to be able to do it, but some people can get into meditation and become addicted in 2 or 3 months. Some people in running can get addicted in 2 or 3 months, but mostly through exercise it takes almost a year. You've got to go kind of a year on faith before you begin to reach this state of affairs. And in most of the other addictions, it's somewhere in this 2 month to a year period. If you don't get it within a year, you're probably going to quit. But now we have even more criteria for positive addiction. It's something that you do, it's something you want to do, it's something that if you don't do it, you feel bad. It's something that allows you to kind of spin out and get your mind in a kind of a free state where it's not attached to you very much. It's kind of on its own. It's something that takes a while to get it going. It's something that you believe you can improve in ordinarily. It's some kind of a self-improvement activity. Even meditation would fall into that category, or yoga, or any of these things. And it takes a while to get there. And once you get there, once you begin to regularly experience this PA state of mind, then if you try to quit, you suffer. That means the PA state of mind, if you regularly experience, is the addictive state of mind, the positively addictive state of mind. Then I began to think this thing out and say, well, what are the circumstances that allow a meditator to get to really into meditation, or a runner to get into this state, or a shuba to do it through swinging a bat, or a yogi person to do it through yoga, or whatever it is? There must be some unifying factor, and I couldn't find what the factor was. And then my friend Ed, who's also a tennis player, I'm a tennis player, sent me a new book, which some of you may have read, Max, who's on the bestseller list, called The Inner Game, about tennis and how to play tennis better through the Zen method. It's Zen tennis, and I'm, you know, not much of a Zenner, but I'll do anything to improve my tennis game. And this guy teaches tennis. And he noticed that the standard teaching technique, which is the standard teaching technique, and here's where this thing starts to have implications for all of our lives, because all of us are teaching. Psychotherapy is teaching people how to live their lives. Education is teaching people about the world around them. Psychotherapy is just a very specific form of teaching. And this man is teaching tennis. And he noticed that when he teaches people tennis, that the average tennis teacher does what most teachers do. He says, now, you know, stand this way, hold the racket such, put your hand back, your wrist up, your wrist down, watch your feet, keep your eye on the ball. A myriad of instructions to try and get the person to hit the ball. And he said he did this for years and years and noticed that generally it was ineffective. But that's how people always taught. And so he continued doing it. But he became concerned about how ineffective it was. How most people peak at a certain point and can't go any further. It was assumed, and has been assumed, and probably still is assumed, that when you attempt an activity and you peak, that is, you reach the limit of your activity, whatever it is, golf, tennis, whatever you're into, that this peak, especially if it's an athletic activity, is determined by your physical ability. But it's probably not true. Probably it's very little determined by our physical ability. It's mostly a mental thing. So he started doing some other things. He noticed, he said, a woman came to him once and said, I want to learn to play tennis so I can play with my husband, but I'm having a terrible time. I can't hit the tennis ball. He said, well, what do you do? She said, invariably, she said, I hit the ball on the wooden frame instead of on the strings. He said, do you do it all the time? She says, always, which is quite a feat in itself. And so he said, well, show me. Well, show me. And so he hit her 10 balls, as a teacher would, just flap 10 balls over the net to her, and every one she hit on the string. And he says, "My God, you do it, don't you?" He says, "That's what I've been telling you." And so he said, "All right, I'd like you to do this. I'd like you to make a conscious effort to do only one thing when I hit the ball to you. I'll hit 10 more balls to you. Try to hit the ball on the frame. Make an effort to hit the ball on the frame." And so he hit her 10 more balls, and she hit 9 of them right smack in the center of the string. And then the 10th ball she hit on the frame. And he said to her, "How come you hit the 10th ball on the frame?" She said, "I was beginning to think I would become a tennis player." Now, that's a subtle point, which I'll try and explain in a few minutes. But she began to get the idea, "My goodness, maybe I'll become a tennis player. And goodness, isn't that difficult?" And as soon as that idea ran through her head, she again was successful in hitting it on the frame. As long as she could concentrate on a kind of trying to do it wrong, and that her teacher not only asked her to do it wrong, he made it a criterion. He accepted it as being wrong. It was okay to do something wrong. In other words, you could do something as stupid as hitting the ball on the frame, and it was okay to a teacher. When that was like accepting her. And when he would do that, when he would say whatever, in a sense he was saying, "No matter how you hit it, I won't criticize you," then she was able to hit it on the strings. And so he began doing a lot of thinking about this. He took another guy out, and he said to this fellow who was having difficulty hitting the ball, "You're going to be the star of a TV show." And this television show, well, among other things, the star is a great tennis player. And in order to build his character, they're going to show him on the tennis court. "And I want you to play this character." This was all a pretend, a charade, but nevertheless, he said, "You're going to play this character." And he said, "Just look good." He said, "Remember, the camera is only on you. It'll never show where the ball goes. Just hit the ball any way at all, just as long as you look great in the process." He says, "You can hit over the fence, you can hit in the net, the camera will only..." It's like, you know, in any movie when they show, if you've ever seen the... what do they call it, those screwy basketball players on television, they show these long shots. If you'll notice, it shows the ball leaving their hand, and then there's a cut, and it shows the ball going through the basket. But it never shows the whole arc on these long shots, because they don't make that many of them. So the point is that this was only going to show them. And when he did this, the man who previously couldn't hit the ball began to hit it beautifully. As long as he didn't have to worry about where the ball was going, well, then he introduced a whole different element to his game. He could just look good, and he was going to be accepted. He was going to be the star. He made impossible shots. And as soon as the teacher said, "Okay, now that's over," he went back to his old way of playing, because it's always available, your old miserable way. And so the teacher thought all this over, and he started thinking, what do we do when we do something ordinarily? We'll just take tennis or golf or anything else. We hit a ball, and we hit it badly, as most of us do quite often. We immediately start to criticize ourselves, really almost putting the words of our old teachers into our mouth. Now, we should have kept our head down. Why don't we keep our head down? We should have taken the racket back further, not back so far. We bent our arm. We should have held it stiff. And we start going through a whole series of self-critical maneuvers. And the more we do this, this teacher noticed, the more we seem to lock ourselves into our game, whatever it was, usually not too good. Then he said, every once in a while you see an athlete on television, a great athlete, and suddenly you see something happen to this athlete. You see it in basketball, perhaps most often, occasionally in tennis, sometimes in baseball when a pitcher gets this way. Sometimes you see it in football when a quarterback suddenly gets hot. And they call it in athletics, he's playing out of his head. And a basketball player starts throwing everything in from no matter where it is. And just one point goes in. Our whole team starts that way. Sometimes the whole team plays out of its head. If any of you watch football, you saw this occur in the third quarter of the USC Notre Dame game, where suddenly the USC whole team played out of their head. The quarterback could have just thrown the ball up in the air and they would have got a touchdown. It wouldn't have made any difference. And when another team is playing against a team that suddenly starts to play out of their head, they become defenseless. They just crumble because they're playing against people that they can't compete with. You see this happen in athletics quite often. Well, the point is that if you're an expert in athletics, then sometimes you can get yourself into a state where literally your mind spins free. You get into the PA state on the floor, where your brain no longer has anything to do with your playing the game in any kind of a critical sense. It just says to your body and a little bit of your brain that's left, enjoy the game, do well, I'm going somewhere else. And in this state, you play this superb way. I think everyone here that's engaged in any athletics has for periods of time experienced that, this out-of-your-head playing. Now, the teacher of the book says, if you're up against an opponent doing that and you want to get out of that terrible situation you're in where he's totally destroying you, just say to him very sweetly, how come you're playing so well today? He said, and as soon as you do that, he'll return to his old miserable game because he'll start thinking, my goodness, I am playing well. The same as the lady who said, remember at the end of the 10th ball, she says, my goodness, I was thinking I could become a tennis player. And as soon as she thought that, right back on the wood again. And so if you tie all this thing together, I came to the conclusion from reading this book and thinking about this and my own experience, because I've used this in my own tennis game, which is not that great a game, but became a heck of a lot better after I read the book, and continues to improve if I can, in a sense, let myself alone. If I can play tennis and hit a bad shot and do it existentially, by that I mean that shot is over, it's gone, it's done, never be hit again, my next shot's coming up, I'm starting with a clean slate, maybe I'll hit a good one this time. And not burdening myself with, why did I make that stupid shot? I should have hit it that way and I hit it over here and oh, it was so dumb and everything like that. Not only do you ruin that shot when you criticize yourself, you ruin the next 9 shots. And so it's just a very, very destructive thing. And most teaching leads us to that destruction. Whether it's teaching of an athletic or whether it's teaching in school, most teaching is very highly critical teaching, which induces self-criticism, which locks the person, in a sense, away from his capacity. It locks him away from his capacity. So, without talking more about this, I came to the conclusion that the criterion for a positive addiction, whether it's meditating, whether it's chanting, whether it's yoga, whether it's running, whatever it is, the criterion is to get yourself into an activity which you can do, which you believe is valuable to some extent for you, and which you can do in a totally, or as much as you can totally, non-self-critical way. Now, this is a very, very difficult thing to do. And lots of people will never be able to do this because all of our lives we've been raised in a whole, you could say we've been bathed with criticism. We've been said, watch yourself, be careful, do the right thing, and all these kinds of things. I'm not saying that that's a wrong way to raise a person, but evidently most of us have had way too much. And when we try to do it in terms of things we're attempting to do, it's just like role-playing and things like this. A lot of people here probably would like to play a role, but they would never come up and do it because they would say, oh my goodness, I'll do something wrong, or I'll make a fool of myself, or something like that. So this self-critical thing limits you terribly. It doesn't allow you. Now, I noticed yesterday as we got into it, several people who I'm sure wouldn't have played roles decided, oh, what the heck, everyone was enjoying it and things like that. And obviously, no one was criticizing anyone. It was a good time. And so I think a lot of people felt much more relaxed and felt able to come up and do it than if you ask people initially and things like that. It's this self-critical thing which is so destructive of our functioning. So I think that's the critical factor in positive addiction, the crucial factor. That why would a person, for instance, who's out running 6 o'clock in the morning in the cold, criticize himself? I mean, who's he hurting, He's out there doing his damnedest to improve his stamina, whatever it is, avoid a heart attack or whatever he's running for. But the thing is that it's almost totally non-self-critical. Now here's the runner from Toronto running, and another runner in the neighborhood swings in alongside of him. What does he do? As soon as possible, he turns off and he says, "See ya." Doesn't want to run with another runner. Why doesn't he want to run with another runner? He doesn't want to run because if he starts running with him, what he says is pretty soon we start pacing each other. Pretty soon one quickens it or something, and you get a tiny bit of competition going. And as soon as you do that, you begin to say, well, am I winning? Am I losing? How am I doing? And as soon as you do that, you lose the state. And so most people who are involved in positive addictions, again, similar to people with negative addictions, but most people don't want to do it with anybody else. They want to do it by themselves. They don't want any competitive thing involved. And most of us who play athletics, who aren't professionals, will never ever be reached this out of our head stage for more than a few minutes. A pro sometimes can reach it for long periods of time and gives them a real feeling of his of enjoyment much more above than he would ordinarily get. Because he has the skill to reach it, and he has the strength to reach it. But if you look at some professionals, they put a lot into it. Shuba swung the bat 600 times a day. Jerry West, the basketball player, threw 500 baskets a day, every day for years and years, 500 baskets. And he lived on a hill in West Virginia, and if he missed the basket, the ball rolled all the way down the hill. And so he had a tremendous incentive to have it go through the basket so it wouldn't roll all the way down the hill. And these kinds of things. Well, these people did this by themselves, and I'm sure that what looked like discipline, which is discipline in the beginning, becomes the PA state later. They actually begin to do it, and their mind spins out. And they get this intense pleasure in the process, and that's what they become addicted to. The chanter got this too. He didn't like chanting, but he became addicted to what was going on in his head. While this chanting was going on, his brain was able to escape. Now, then the question arises, if this is true, well, several questions arise. How does this make you stronger? And what happens in a negative addiction? Because I think we have to answer those questions. Because negative addictions don't make you stronger. And yet, obviously, a negative addict must also reach a very similar state of mind. Well, this is all speculation on my part. I have some evidence to back it up, but it's speculation, and you know, we don't have to take it as the gospel truth, but think about it, and if it seems to make sense to you, then you can use the ideas. If it doesn't make any sense, just forget it. That's all. It won't hurt you. And so, if you talk about strength, let's talk about strength for a minute. What makes a strong... We all know what a strong person is. A person who's decisive, a person who can handle himself, a person when stress comes along, he knows how to do things and things like that. A person who can find love and worth. A strong person has more zest in his life. He lives a fuller life. It's a more imaginative life, a richer life, something like that. Well, where does he get the strength from? He gets it from love and worth, interaction with other people, the way he's raised. We discussed that yesterday. But I think he also, in some cases, gets it from positive addiction. Now let me explain how this happens. I think what makes a strong person strong is he has faith in his brain. That he says to himself, or he has this feeling, it's a feeling, it's not so much a thought as I think it's a feeling. He has this feeling of confidence. See, confidence is something real. Like if you're a very, very good ping pong player and you go to play ping pong, then you have real confidence that you can play ping pong, and that's a tangible confidence. But many people who are strong have this feeling of confidence which is not tangibly applied as they go through their lives. It's just there. And when a situation comes up, they handle it well. And one of the reasons they handle it well is they have this feeling of confidence which applies to things which they know about, which they may have prepared for, but it also applies to things that they don't know about, that they have no preparation for, that they're in this situation and they have confidence. Like, oh, you read about all these stress situations where people are marooned or shipwrecked or plane wrecked and things like that. And some people get out and some don't. And the difference is that the strong people usually get out. Not necessarily the physically strong or the healthy people, but the people who have mental strength. And what is this mental strength? I think it is that their brains can always come up with an option. They never run out of things that they believe they can do. There's a classic and very, very funny cartoon which was published in Playboy magazine, in the back of the magazine, probably 15 years ago. I never forgot this cartoon, and I think most of it's a classic. We've all seen it. These two emaciated prisoners are chained high on a wall, about 20 feet up on a wall, hand and foot just chained, hanging there, emaciated with rags and beard and scraggly looking. And one prisoner turns to the other one and says, "Now here's my plan. That's a person with mental strength. I mean, if you read about, if you read Viktor Frankl's books about life in the concentration camp, how the strong people survived and the weaker people didn't make it. I mean, it wasn't always that way, but to some extent there was a differentiation between these two. This latest book, which I'm just reading alive, about this shipwreck and plane wreck in the Andes where they survived and things like that. Well, what I think is they have options. Now, if you think of your brain, all of us have about the same brain. Some of our brains have a little more capacity than others, but I'm not impressed that much with the difference, inherent difference in people's intelligences as perhaps other people are. There may be some inherent differences, but most of us are smart enough. What happens that some of us succeed more effectively, lead our lives in a better way, is that we have more strength than others. Now, strength is perhaps slightly tied to intelligence, but it's much more tied to other things. It's tied to being able to figure out what to do when you really don't know what to do, to have options. And where do these options come from? Well, they come from the things that we learn as we grow, certainly. If we look at our brain, most all of us have brains with about 2 billion neurons in the thinking part of our brain, the cerebrum, like around 2 billion neurons. That's a lot of neuron cells. And we think with these neurons. I don't know how we think with them. I'm not a physiologist or anything like that. But obviously, they don't think with them individually. I'm sure that they hook up in certain ways, and this ways develop patterns of thought and things like that. And so if you're up against an unknown situation, if you can hook your neurons up in a certain way, then maybe you can solve the problem. If your neurons will never hook up in a way that problem will be solved, you'll never solve it. And the difference between strong people, I think, and weak people is strong people have more neuronal hookups available. They've got more of them hooked up. Now, if you look at this thing mathematically, if you've got 2 billion neurons, we will never in our lifetime ever begin to hook 2 billion neurons up in all the possible ways. We have unlimited possibilities left in our heads no matter how much we use them. But some people just have them hooked up more than others. Some people in a tough situation will just say, "I don't know what to do." If you go back to yesterday's opening lecture, what happens to the weak? What happens to the people who... they give up. They say, "I don't know what to do. I just give up," and settle for a very repetitive, painful symptom as maybe a limited option. But strong people don't give up. They bear the pain, they keep plugging away, and they keep saying, "There must be a way, there must be a pathway, there must be something I can do, there must be something I can find." If you read this book, I'm sure some of you read the book or maybe seen the movie. I haven't seen the movie, but I read the book called Papillon. He survived a horrible thing of solitary confinement by letting his brain spin out for hours at a time. He actually came out of solitary confinement stronger than he went in, much to the amazement of his jailers. He literally let himself go and almost enjoyed some of these long periods of solitary confinement because he let his brain leave his body and his brain traveled all over the world and had all kinds of fun. Now, you could call this crazy, but it wasn't crazy for him in solitary confinement. It preserved him. So what I now postulate is this. And this again is my idea. It's not necessarily true. It may be totally wrong, but it's my idea. And I think it makes sense. Whether or not it exactly works this way, I don't know, but I think it works somewhat like this. Is that you increase your mental pathways whenever you experience love, you increase your mental pathways. Because the essence of love is the non-self-critical condition. If your lover criticizes you, love very rapidly disappears. This is why marriage kills love. Because if you're married for any long period of time, it's very hard to remain non-critical of each other as you were in the beginning. So you have to work very hard at marriage not to do this and to build other things that you can enjoy together. Because if you don't build much, you're going to end up criticizing each other. And when you do that, love will literally turn to hate, as it often does when marriages dissolve into divorce. All the things they liked about the person when they married him, they now hate about him. It's amazing how the thing flip-flops, you know. He was so lackadaisical and so free, and now he's such a lackadaisical goddamn bum, he never does anything. See, the two things, you know, it just totally shifts over. Well, whenever you achieve something also, and people say it's good, you get this feeling of freedom too. You get this feeling that, my goodness, they really accept me now. So the essence of both love and worth is to achieve, both directly learn things, and also achieve little periods of this non-self-critical state. But it's very haphazard, although it happens. And the more we have love and worth, the more we actually learn to do things with our lives, the more we achieve these little periods of non-self-critical state. And this strengthens our brain. Now, love and worth do it directly, but the non-self-critical state does it indirectly. Therefore, if you're in this PA state that the chanter was in, the jogger's in, the meditator's in, if you can get into this state where your brain spins free, what happens then is that on its own, because I think this is a natural thing for your brain to do, it does, in little children this happens all the time, that's where they learn and gain strength. But as soon as we start to see them do it, we say, that's wrong, that's no good, you know. Little kid goes off in his room and he starts to really daydream and spin out. We say, now kid, buckle down, you know, that's not good, don't daydream, you know. And life is real, life is earnest, you know, and we lock them into these very limited pathways. But if we can leave children alone, and the great children of the world, some of the things that you can see when you see their lives is they either were left alone or they left themselves. They got into periods where they left themselves alone. And if we can achieve this as an adult, which is harder through meditating or running or something like that, if we can let our mind alone, it grows. It grows on its own. The neurons, being left alone, start to hook up in all kinds of free and unusual ways. And as they do, you develop a whole series of pathways which you may never use, but now you've got them. They're there. And so the feeling you get, and this is a feeling, is I am more confident for having had this. And your reason you get this feeling is you're like a person with more resources available, even though you don't particularly necessarily use the resources specifically, like you'd use to solve a problem. 2 and 2 and 4 is a neural pathway. Use it for that problem. But now you've got a lot of pathways, all kinds of pathways available, and you feel confident, but you don't know if you'll use them or not. But here comes a stressful situation, a situation where maybe something terrible happens to you, and you throw yourself into solving the stressful situation, and suddenly you're able to draw upon these pathways which were there. This feeling of confidence becomes translated into an actual operational thing. And this operational thing is what gives people more strength. They've actually got more of their brain available. And since we have 2 billion neurons anyway, we'll never, ever begin to hook them up in all the possible ways. If we lived 1 million years, we couldn't use all the potential hookups within our brain. But what most of us never begin to realize is all the strength that's there, because we spend our lives never allowing our brains to be. We use them very directly, like you'd use a crowbar, instead of letting them be and gaining this potential growth. Now, the payoff for this potential growth, feeling-wise, is an intense feeling of pleasure when your brain is in this growing, expanding state, this transcendent, spinning free, expanding state. Intense pleasure, passive pleasure, not tied to anything definite. It's just the inherent pleasure within the organ itself, the potential within your own head. So, if a person can, of course, live a life with lots of love, he'll have this state at times because he'll experience non-self-critical state where he leaves himself alone. One of the reasons that falling in love feels so good, one of the things I thought was silly but now so accurate about the book Love Story is when Eric Segal said, love is saying never having to say you're sorry. This is again tied to this non-self-critical state, the acceptance of one another. This is what makes love such a tremendously both active pleasure experience by experiencing the other person, but also the passive pleasure of the other person allows you to be alone. A good teacher would do this to you also. This is how he teaches Zen tennis and teaches you to do it himself. Achievement will do the same thing. You actually achieve something, and when you achieve it, you can relax for a minute, like climbing a mountain. You climb to the top, it's hard work, and then when you get there, it feels so good. I've achieved it. Who's going to criticize me now? Here I am on top of the world. Now, of course, eventually you have to climb down and join life. You can't stay there forever, but the point is, in those moments, you get that feeling, and that's why people climb mountains. This is why they do that. They say, I climb them because they're there. This is why surfers look for the perfect wave. They get that feeling when they go down it. These are all part of the feeling that you get it haphazardly and occasionally, or you can produce it through certain ways. But if you get into a positive addiction, you can make it happen literally every day. If you're able to do this, this is what that 26-mile runner in England gets. I start to get excited as soon as I lace on my shoes. I start to spin out as I run down the street, and I hardly know when the run is over. Well, this man, I'm sure, is a very strong man. And what he experiences is this almost direct way to allow your brain to go strong through leaving it alone. And this is the positive addiction state. Can everybody reach it? I don't think so. But many people are trying to reach it. A lot of meditators. Do all the meditators actually reach the state in meditation? I think only a few do. But if you reach it, you know about it. And if you get into what the yogi calls deep meditation, that's when you're really there. Now, there are stages of this, too. And I don't want to go into it, but the point is it goes in stages and things like that. There's more to it than I want to go into today. But the point is that's the place you're at. And this is the positive addiction state. And it makes your mind grow, and it gives you this all these new pathways to increase your imagination. And imagination is what makes life worth living. If you're a non-imaginative person, your life is black and white. If you're an imaginative person, your life is a series of colors and things like that. It's just a different kind of a life altogether. Now, how does this tie up with negative addiction? The tie-up is interesting. It's very, very close. What negative addiction does, and let's talk about it in terms of drugs, because I think by far that you reach it the most in drugs. You can reach it probably in other ways, but drugs are the most common. I think that when you take heroin has an ability to get rid of the pain. It also has an ability to let your mind spin free. You achieve in a negative addiction essentially the same state that you achieve in a positive addiction. An intensely pleasurable state. But it's a passive pleasure, obviously. If you study addicts, they don't want any. They want it all by themselves. They don't want anybody else. And now the question then arises is why does an addiction make you strong? And the answer to that question, as far as I can figure out, I'm asking myself and answering all these questions, because addiction doesn't make you strong, except in one area. It does make you strong in one area. Tremendously strong and resourceful and imaginative in one area. That's in the area of your addiction. Nobody's more resourceful than a heroin addict than getting his heroin, as those of you who work with him certainly know, or dodging the test or any of these things. But they have no strength in any other area. They'll let their whole life go to waste, practically. They'll let their body go to pot. They'll let their relationships all deteriorate and everything else. Well, what happens is that when you achieve the PA state through a negative addiction, through, let's say, heroin or alcohol, you only have the state for as long as you have the intoxication. And as soon as it wears off, you're right back to where you were. And it's like being left out of jail for a little while and then having to come back. The pathways don't form permanently. They only form during this period, and then they go back. So really all you get out of it is the pleasure. You don't get much of the strength. But it's more complex than that. The difference between a positive and negative addict is the positive addict can use the strength gained in the PA state directly in active pleasure activities. He can use them to find love and worth in his life. And as he does so, his life becomes more stronger and in a more active sense as well as in this passive sense. And the reason he can use them is he's strong to begin with. It takes a lot of strength to get into the PA state. And this strength is based upon the fact that the positive addict has not given up on love and worth. He hasn't given up on love and worth, hasn't at all. He takes an hour a day off for his addiction, but the rest of the day he's pursuing love and worth. He has the love and worth pathways there. And the strength he gains through his positive addiction, through creating new and unusual pathways, are immediately and sometimes directly translated to love and worth. The negative addict has given up on love and worth. He thinks it's impossible to get. He's suffering pain and spends all his time to get rid of the pain. The addicting activity gets rid of the pain and allows him to spin free for a while. Now, when he's spinning free for a while, he is stronger. He actually is stronger. And at that moment, he can make a decision. He can say, okay, will I use this strength to find love and worth? But if he attempts to use that strength to find love and worth, then for all practical purposes, he's got to give up his intoxication. He's got to give up his stoned up state. He's got to go out into the world without his addiction. But as soon as he stops his addiction, his strength disappears. So under the addiction, when he feels strong and acts strong and exciting and all the wonderful things that you see sometimes people are when they're intoxicated, they can't really use it, because if they make an attempt to use it, as soon as their addiction wears off, which it necessarily will, then the strength wears off. So it's like they're reaching for the moon and suddenly they can't reach it because the thing goes away. So what they do is they merely settle for the state, for the pleasure, and for the temporary strength which they can use only in one area toward furthering their addiction. And then when it wears off, they not only hurt again because their old pain returns, but they hurt because they actually feel the contraction in their mind of the loss of these pathways. It's like you're let out of jail and you're having a great time and suddenly they grab you and throw you back in jail. If they did that to you every day, people would say, gee, don't even let me out. If I have to suffer the pain of getting thrown back in here, I don't even want to get out. This is a classic statement of people saying, if I can't be really free, you know, don't do it. Or people will say this in terms of a love relationship. If you really don't care for me, just don't give me a kiss. I mean, I don't want it if you really don't care. It's all part and parcel of the same kind of an experience. And so the addict more and more only uses his strength to further his addiction, which gets him the pleasure, and the other strengths become unavailable to him because they're too long range, they're too far gone, far away, and he can only get them in his addicted state, but in his addicted state, no one will pay any attention to him anyway. No one will respect him anyway. So when he gives that up, he doesn't have the strength, so he's locked into this position. Entirely different from the positive addict, who uses this newfound strength in lots of other ways. Now, the positive addict does experience the same thing the negative addict does. I'll just wind up with this. When his addiction is taken away from him, he suffers. When the runner, Joe Henderson, the great, great runner in this country, whom I'm in correspondence with, broke his ankle, he suffered the tortures of the damned. He couldn't run. And so this expansion he expected every day in his head, he couldn't get. And he really suffered, almost like a heroin addict coming down off heroin. But it's not nearly as great because he has strength besides and other things in his life. But for him, because everyone experiences their own thing, for him it was quite a come down. He suffers quite a bit. But all he has to do to get it going again is get his ankle healed and he starts running and it's fine. So he can intellectually understand that, although he suffers. Now the other thing is when a positive addict if he's deprived of his addiction, naturally he won't hurt as much because he has other things to do. Now there's one other thing which I forgot. I had it for a minute and I forgot it. See, a negative addict, just gone. That's all there is to it. Sometimes you get an idea and it's there and I was all set to say it and it's gone. But all I can say is it has to do with the fact that a positive addict doesn't suffer nearly as much as a negative addict because he can, this isn't it, this is another thing, he has the active pleasure to fall back on when he loses his passive pleasure, which is the pleasure almost all of us have in our lives. The negative addict has nothing to fall back on. He has no active pleasure. All he has is the passive pleasure. And so he's stuck more and more into his addiction because that's the only pleasure that he has. But the positive addict does have this active pleasure. Now, this is what I want to talk about. Why doesn't a positive addict do his thing all day long? A heroin addict, if he's left, he'll do it all day long. You know, he's never stopped taking heroin. As soon as he comes down, he wants to go up again. A positive addict, for the most part, my data shows, settles for about an hour a day. And if you don't put about an hour a day into it, you won't reach positive addiction. The reason he settles for it is he's sensible. That's all. Positive addiction people are sensible. They say, if I did this all day long, I would have no chance to find the active pleasures in life. If I settle only for the passive pleasure, he doesn't want to do that. He uses the passive pleasure as a key to enhance his active pleasure. Therefore, an hour a day is enough. Further is, if he did it all day long, he would become self-critical. He would say, this is stupid. So you can only devote a certain amount of your life in the real world that we live in to this activity. After that, you'd say, well, if I do it all day long, that's a dumb thing to do. And as soon as he becomes self-critical, he loses it. So most addicts seem to settle for about an hour a day and a few more hours on the weekends. That's what it comes to. Now, if you're a runner that does it 2 hours a day like this marathon runner, that's fine because you this is the kind of thing. Well, that's the difference between negative and positive addiction. They're similar in some respects, but one gains you strength, the other doesn't. They both feel good, but one feeling good doesn't lead to any more strength. They're both passive feelings, but the passive feeling of negative addiction is never translated into any active feelings because you can't reach them, you've given up on them, they're not there. The passive good feelings of positive addiction are directly translated into strength, which is used in the active pleasures of your life, and snowballs you into this stronger, more confident feeling. And the guilt, of course, is when you don't do it, and you'll have that, but you won't suffer. If you were involved in a positive addiction and you have to give it up, you'll suffer quite a bit, but it'll only be suffering. It won't ruin your life. And gradually you'll either find something else or you'll just settle for active pleasures, which are sufficient in most cases. So the point of this all, just to wrap it up finally in one other thing, and then we can have some questions later. We'll have a break in a second. The point of it is that there are generally two ways to gain strength in life, through love and worth, that most of us use, and most of us just about only use these, and we have little haphazard episodes of spinning out as we find love and worth and we get peace in our life here and there, and we enjoy those things. The positive addiction phenomenon adds another dimension to our lives through which we can gain strength. And we don't have to be dependent upon other people. We can do this by ourselves. Let's say most of us in this room are between 25 and 50 years of age, 60 years of age. At this point in our lives, we have about the amount of love we're going to have. I mean, we could get a little more, a little less, but that's where we're kind of where we are in love, that's about it. So whatever strength we can get through love, this is what we got. We have about as much worth as we're going to have. We can get a little more, we can lose a little, but that's again where we are. So our strength remains at a relatively whatever level it's at, usually quite adequate. But for instance, let's say that your strength in your life right now, let's say you're 40 years of age, and you've got a certain amount of love, you've got a certain amount of worth, and your strength is running on a scale of 10, you're running at about 6, which is quite satisfactory. You're leading a good life and you're happy about it. But let's say you decide for some reason or other, I want to increase my strength. Can you suddenly go out at age 40 and find a lot more love? It's not practical. It really isn't practical. And people try it, but sometimes causes upset. Can you suddenly at age 40 get a big shot of self-worth? Yes, you could climb Mount Everest barefoot or something like that, but not too many people are going to do it. So if you want to increase the strength potential, which is, say, setting at an arbitrary scale of 10 at 6 on a scale of 10, if you can get into a positive addictive activity, say running, say meditating, yoga, whole bunch of them, bike riding, exercises, knitting, needle pointing, some woman takes warm baths and does it. I've just got a whole series of people that are doing it in various ways. In other words, figuring a non-self-critical activity to let your brain spin out. If you can do that, there's a very good chance you can raise your basic level of strength and increase the enjoyment you have in your present life by that percentage. That's the advantage to this. It has no downside. It only has the potential upside. Can everybody reach it? I doubt it. I think some of us are programmed to be too self-critical. We can never, ever achieve this freedom. And some of us, I'm sure, can reach it quite easily. The yogi is popular now because he's showing some people in the Western world a way to reach it. And some of them, not nearly all of them, but some of them are actually reaching it that way, and it's doing, like for this sons of this friend of mine, and a tremendous amount of good. So there's some other things we could talk about, but this thing goes on endlessly. Let's leave it here with that summary. And maybe we can take a break now for we have a message here. Your lights are on, a Georgia license, PAG 578. Let's break for about 15 minutes and then may have some questions or some more role playing. If you can help your client to get into a state where he doesn't criticize himself in your relationship, then that's an active state, obviously, like love, but it certainly is a state in which people can grow. And so if the client comes to you and you're continually saying, well, what are you doing, and that's no good, and things like that, it's not going to work. This is why reality therapy says to the person, what are you doing, and is that helping you? Now, that's a time when he would be self-critical. But the idea of reality therapy is to carry it to the next step, which is, okay, if that's not helping you, can you figure out something better, and I'll help you? And then he can move into the non-self-critical state and achieve something. And whereas this isn't at all the same thing as positive addiction, it's still the implications of it are the same. The importance of the non-self-critical state, he's not going to spin out or any of those things during this time. But nevertheless, the more non-self-critical we can get our client when he's actually doing something, not just non-self-critical because I love heroin and that's great, but non-self-critical because I'm now doing something to improve where I previously was critical. I'd like to also stress, there's nothing wrong with self-criticism. It's not a destructive thing necessarily at all, providing it leads the person to some place that he can correct it. If I walk around with my shoes untied, it would be good if I'd look at my shoes and see that they're untied and tie them. I can correct that. The thing that you don't want to get people into as a teacher, as a therapist, as a parent, is criticize a person and then get him in a position where he can do nothing about it. This is a destructive self-critical state. This is what happens so often in athletic instruction and why it's so destructive. Trying to correct a person's golf swing, and the more you criticize it, the poorer he swings. And this is totally, according to this teacher, and I believe it, almost a totally destructive thing. He can't correct it until he leaves himself alone. And the more you nag at him, the less chance he has of doing this. This is why nagging is different from just a concise, critical thing and then leave it go. Why nagging is so much more destructive. Well, the trouble is you could talk about about this forever. The only other thing I'd like to say is the implications for child rearing to me are tremendous. Little kids have a tendency to spin out. They don't spin out all the time, but they have tendencies to do this. This is how they grow. And if we stop that, if we say that's wrong, stop it, don't daydream, do something constructive, you know, then this is of course, we're just like breaking the child's legs, only we're doing worse. We're in a sense breaking his brain. The other thing has a religious connotation to it, for reasons which I don't know, because I'm not a religious person. Many religions have a highly self-critical connotation. To the extent that they are, they will cause those people who follow the religions to become weaker instead of stronger. This is a very, very important thing, that if you're involved in a religion, it shouldn't be a self-critical thing. It should be a thing where has some love and some acceptance to it and things like that. The old fire and brimstone thing, it didn't do any good for anybody. It caused a lot of people to become weaker instead of stronger. Now, are there any questions? I mean, just yes, go ahead. Is it possible for a person, like say he's negatively addicted, to get involved in a positively addicting activity and gain the strength to give up his negative addiction? That's essentially the question. This is a very important question, and one which I'm pondering, because I have in my questionnaire, has this process helped you to get over any bad habits? I have a lot of people who've written me they've stopped smoking, which is not really a negative addiction, but is close to it. Smoking doesn't really ruin your life or anything like that, but it's an addiction. A lot of people have been able to control their diet and weight much more satisfactorily. Again, a bad habit. Some people have reported, as this monk did, that when he got into chanting, he was able to give up being an alcoholic, which is a very definite negative addiction. And I have quite a few people who've written, well, I drink a lot less, but I don't know if it's connected. You see, because they're hesitant to make the connection, but I have this data. I haven't got any data on heroin addicts and whether it would be possible for a heroin addict to get into some kind of a positively addicting activity. I don't know. Obviously, on the face of it, it would be very difficult, because a positive addiction has to go for quite a bit of time on faith, which is strength, before you get there. You don't jog and get right into this state. It takes a year in most cases. You have to run a year on the idea it's helping my heart and helping my legs and this kind of a thing. Meditation, less time, but I think even though it takes less time, it's easier to get into it through jogging, if you understand what I mean. Meditation is a quicker way, but I think it's less open. I think Western man is too self-critical to make it through meditating. But when you're jogging and you really get tired, you can finally begin to spin out. And so, but it takes longer. And I don't understand all this. I just have a lot of data on it. But I would say that positive addiction is not going to be a major factor in helping weak people to get stronger as it is in helping strong people to get stronger. But even so, it's a very valuable concept, even if it'll do that. Because the more that strong people are stronger, the more they will be able to support and help the weak. So it will be indirectly helpful to the weak. There's another question. Yes? Yes, most... The question is, if a runner is unable to continue a positive addiction, let's say he loses a leg, you know, something like that, they can substitute another thing, but it seems not to be as satisfactory. It's like a heroin addict substituting methadone. It works, but it's not as good. Obviously, methadone doesn't provide either the spinning out or as much relief from pain as heroin. Just not as good. Joe Henderson rode a bike during the period. And with a broken ankle, he could still ride a bike. He couldn't pound down on the ankle, but the ankle in the cast, he could ride a bike. He said it helped, but it wasn't as good. And I'm getting this from a lot of people. Some people hurt their back. One woman reports that she was a pretty much of an exerciser and hurt her back and went into swimming. And swimming just about did as much for her as the other. So sometimes you can shift and sometimes not. But I have a feeling that once you find your thing, it's not that easy to shift one to another. Mm-hmm. Maybe they could meditate or something like that. See, the thing I don't know is how transferable these things are. And whether, see, a lot of people are into transcendental meditation. It's very popular. Hundreds of thousands. Some of them, I'm sure, a large percentage, although not nearly the percentage that they claim, reaches the PA state. They claim about 50% reach it. I don't think it's anywhere near that number. However, the thing that I have no idea about is whether or not a meditator could go into running or vice versa, and whether this would work for him or not. In theory, it should, but theory and practice are two different things. And for instance, a runner who runs around the countryside won't get into the state running on a track. He wants to run the countryside. There's something about it. A runner who runs and it's a nasty day and he can't run, like too much snow, will run at home, but it'll just relieve the pain. He won't get any pleasure from it. And so it's a very tricky thing. And I just have to accept what people say, because there's no reason for people to lie about this. And I can't explain it all. I just know that's the way it is. That's all. Joe Henderson says, he's the editor of Runner's World, and a runner for from 11 years old to 34. He's a runner for 23 years. Joe says that there's something about your feet touching the ground that helps you to do this, that it doesn't work on a carpet in a house or something like this. And there's something about covering ground that's different from running on a treadmill or running in place. And I just don't know. I mean, I got to accept what he says. Yes. Maybe I'm not acquainted with what Pearl's writing, but maybe it's the same thing. It's similar to what Maslow described in A Peak Experience, I have a feeling, too. Although Maslow didn't differentiate between the active and the passive components of this, and didn't talk about the non-self-critical aspect, because I guess he didn't think about it, that's all. But he did describe that very strong people experience peak experiences. Now, you could look it around. Peak experiences may make very strong people strong. Undoubtedly, it's a circular thing. So, but Pearls is somebody I have no real knowledge of what he did or said. And his work, I never got into at all. Yes? Well, that's what meditators try to do. Well, they have a way of trying to set their mind aside, but basically that's what they... I mean, there's all kinds of systems to try and get your mind aside. You can tie yourself into a pretzel like a yoga person, and the pretzel is what allows your mind to be. Your body is so involved in this pretzel that your mind is alone. But obviously, what you're trying to do, and you usually have to do it in a room by yourself, is to set your mind aside. And if you can do it, you don't need all these other things. In other words, what I'm trying to describe, if this book is published and people read it, I think a lot of people have ways to do this that they didn't talk much about. You know, they just said they did it, and they kind of, you know, they don't want to tell people they set themselves aside every day for an hour, so they just do it, you know. And what the meditators have done is make it kind of legitimate. But also, everybody is selling their thing. Like TM says, this is the greatest, you know, and he'll go out for $100, we'll train you and stuff like that, which is fine. I think it's cheap, actually, if it does a lot for you. I'm not a meditator myself, but the point is, one is not better than another. And when they get into the idea that one is better than another, that's baloney. Once you reach the state, no matter how you reach it, just as good as any other way. You don't reach it better through TM or better through yoga or better through running. The state's all the same. The hard part is getting there. If you can get there through just going in a room, closing a door, and leaving yourself be, why, that's just great. And nothing wrong with that at all. Yes? I don't call it irrational, because I don't really think it's irrational, but it has a rationality of its own. It's certainly based upon all your past experiences and everything else. It doesn't come out of the clear blue, but your brain is capable of having permutations and combinations which you've never experienced before. This, I'm sure, happens. To reach it, I talked about the non-self-critical aspect, which is important, very important. It's almost as if you have to work at not working. It's hard to describe it, but you have to work at... One girl, I once made a statement to a group and said that the best thing to do is not to work at it, just to kind of let it be. But one girl said, no, when I got this way through running, I actually worked at letting my mind alone. And maybe you can do that. I couldn't deny it. It's what she said. And she said, I have achieved it after about a year of running. And she now runs regularly. My daughter just started to run. She's kind of a person that has this kind of a personality that she can really do things that are disciplined. And she's really very quickly into running. She doesn't run that far. She hasn't built herself up much. But she runs about 3/4 of a mile now. It takes her, I don't know how many minutes. And she's working into it. And she's describing, although I haven't talked to her about this at all, I haven't spent any time talking to her about this, but she's now describing to me, you know, Dad, I feel good after I run. Now, she had been a disciplined ballet-type dancer for many years and had to give that up, and it may be that she's returning to that kind of a discipline through running. But it's just interesting, yes. Mm-hmm. The question is this an individual thing only? The problem with doing it in a group is that it's harder to be non-self-critical of yourself around others than it is by yourself. I mean, if you just sit in a room with another person, the way we're raised, and I'm sure it's nothing wrong with the way we're raised, but I mean, you know, our mothers have told us now when you're with somebody else, sit up straight and all this kind of thing. It's just that's the way it is, that's all. Now, if you're with others who are able to totally accept you, and perhaps this would be set up such as this way, it might be advantageous to be with others. But most people, especially if it's an athletic activity, would just leave be by themselves because there's such a competitive thing in athletics. In other words, it's almost impossible to reach this for a non-professional in a competitive athletic state, competitive athletic. A professional who's really super at it can reach it. See, if you look at it this way, this is the home of the Masters Tournament, Augusta. Why do the golfers burn out so quickly? Only Sam Snead is old. The others are almost all young. The reason they burn out isn't physically. There's no very little physical a man. Sam Snead can hit the golf ball practically as well now as he could when he was 20. Golf is not a physical type ad. It's a very precise, like shooting pool in a sense. You can do it when you're older. They burn out mentally. They're in this highly competitive game where 200 enter a tournament and one wins. Really rough, you know. It's not even a team thing where at least the whole 11 win on a football team or the whole 40 on the squad win. And every shot decreases their chances of winning practically. That's not a good shot. And so the game becomes so excruciatingly painful, it becomes so highly self-critical that most of them, as soon as they make a little name for themselves, just don't have the strength to continue. They get a good job at a country club, they appear in a few tournaments, and they make a living, but they just don't want to get in this competitive scene. It's too excruciatingly painful. You just so rarely win. Like Arnold Palmer, I mean, he hasn't won a tournament in years, literally. This must be painful for him. Now, that doesn't mean he doesn't make a good living at golf, but there's a difference between winning and making a living. And so they burn out quickly. Whereas some sports, which are team sports, they can continue longer and things. This has nothing to do with PA. This has to do with the intense self-criticism of the game. Any individual game is usually a young man's game, and it's a rare old man that will continue. Tennis is less so, much less so, because in tennis, all right, you hit a bad shot, it's over, you know. You have thousands of shots in a match, but golf, 70, 80 strokes around the course, my God, and the time after each shot to really look and suffer, it's got to be a game for masochists, that's all there is to it. Mr. Bond Carlton, if Mr. Bond Carlton is in the room, he should come down and get this thing. It's for a phone call. There's a number here. Just come down and get it, and there's a number. Yes?
What are your thoughts on using hypnotic
Well, there are people that are into self-hypnosis and things that say that they're reaching this that way. I don't know. I don't know where hypnotism enters into this. There's something about hypnotism that I have a prejudice against, and therefore I can't push my mind into the hypnotism area. There's something about it that I just think is helps people to become weaker instead of stronger. It's like take your own autonomy away or something. Now, self-hypnosis might be a totally different thing. But since I have this deep and ingrained prejudice against hypnotism, I just haven't been able to get into that, that's all. It's irrational, but that's the way it is. The question over here? Yeah. I think that you can. The fault with religion is that some religions tend to emphasize that you're not as good as another person. You should abjugate yourself, and that you're born with the original sin that somebody committed, and all that is very destructive toward letting your brain go and increasing the state. But if it's a joyous type religion, or a religion which you can accept yourself in the eyes of God, then it could very well. I think a lot of people. I've had the questionnaires filled out by quite a few nuns, many of them who claim they reach this state in their daily prayer and meditation, and say it's a very joyous, happy thing. Well, the question is existentialism. Existentialism is just a philosophical way of approaching life by saying that I am what I will make of myself, and I have the capacity to make more of myself, and it could be tied into this, but I don't know. I mean, I can't answer the question in terms of, is existentialism a way of life? I didn't think it was. I thought it was just a way to describe certain ways of life. But this would be an existential phenomena. In that defined sense, it would be in the existential category of phenomena. That's such a thing. There's another hand up here somewhere. Yes. Well, you may not have been in when I talked about that, but there's nothing wrong with self-criticism if you can do something about it. But if you criticize yourself, like let's say that your father dies. I mean, just saying that he passes away. And you spend the next 10 years criticizing yourself. Well, Dad was sick and I should have gone to Chicago and been with him before he died. Well, see, now that would be destructive self-criticism. He's dead, you didn't go to Chicago, and you can't do anything about it. Constructive self-criticism might be, I'm taking this course in school and I haven't been studying, I better get going and study or I won't pass it. Because you can study and you can do that. Now, so I don't want to tell people to stop criticizing themselves and just say everything I do is great. That would be absolutely, totally ridiculous. But to spend an hour a day doing something which hurts no one, helps yourself, and which you can say, I really have no reason to criticize myself for anything whatsoever during that hour, allows your brain to go. You wouldn't want your brain spinning off all day long, then you'd be like a heroin addict, but that doesn't make sense. A positive addict, what they really say, if you want to get right down to it, when I ask them, why do you just do it for an hour, they say, it's enough. And that's as good an answer as any. If you have this for a period of time, it's enough. Just like there are just certain things you do in life, and if you do them a certain amount of time, it's enough. And that's the way it is. Mr. Conrad Stapleman, call Kathy at the county office as soon as possible. Columbia City Board of Education. Is there a question up here? No, I haven't. I want to do some studying, and I don't know how I'm going to do this. I have a guy working for me now helping me. I'd like to look over the lives of so-called prominent people and see if there is some PA state in their life that, in other words, by reading their biographies and things like that. Biographers ordinarily wouldn't cover this to any great extent. I think the reason that these books were so popular, these books by Carlos Castaneda and Don Juan, were that he was really saying, this is the state you reach, and you don't do it with drugs and other stuff. You know, drugs may be how you begin to experience it, but when you really get there, you don't need drugs or anything else. That there are some people in this world who are obviously pretty darn strong, that you read about through history and things like that, and have they utilized some state like this to increase their strength? I think many, many people do this haphazardly or even regularly, but not realizing they do it. All I'm doing is making something, kind of explaining something that I think goes on a lot more than we believe. See, the interesting part again is that the joggers, the runners, I shouldn't say joggers, runners, are reluctant to talk about the mental aspect of what they do. They think, well, people will think they're screwy, you know, that I spin out when I run. And it's a very tricky thing. We live in a very critical culture of anyone not being straight and absolutely thinking right down the line and things like that. But the mystics, I don't know. I know what makes a mystic, and I don't know much about that. This girl, yes. There, yes. Oh, yes, right. Compulsion is like a hand-washing compulsion or something like that. That doesn't do anything for you. You do that just to relieve pain and anxiety, and as soon as you stop it, you have to do it again. And you don't spin out in the process. All you really do is that, for some reason or other, the compulsion relieves some pain during the time you do the compulsion, but it doesn't provide any pleasure whatsoever. All it does is relieve pain, and it's nowhere near the same thing. Like you might say, a workaholic is not a positive addict. He's a guy that's just compelled to work all the time. Also, a compulsion doesn't give you any strength. It doesn't increase your chances of finding more love and worth. If anything, if you're spending all your time washing your hands, that's about all you'll ever do. So a compulsion is a much different thing. Yes. Let me say that so others can hear it. You can also achieve a great deal in this world by being highly self-critical and using that self-criticism to motivate you to do something. There's nothing wrong with that. I don't think you'll reach this PA state, but let's say if you're... In other words, this PA state is not the whole thing. I don't want anyone to appreciate this is the whole. This is an added facet of, I think, what human beings may experience. But a person may push himself through self-criticism to become. I really think that a graphic example of that is Richard Nixon, who I think is a highly self-critical man who pushed himself to be president. Really pushed himself right to the top. In that process, but didn't gain much strength in the process, didn't gain much depth or breadth or compassion or any of these things, just pushed himself to get there, and then found it difficult once there to handle all the stress and strain of the situation that he was in. So I don't say that self-criticism won't get you there, but it may get you there at a price which is not worth paying. There's a lot of I can't think of them now, but there's a lot of novels and books about people like What Makes Sammy Run, the novel by Bud Schulberg. He certainly pushed himself to get there. But once he's there, what does he have? And he's there, that's all. Yes. Oh, you have to push yourself to get going. But, I mean, that's a difference between a fellow playing a guitar and pushing himself and disciplining himself to practice and finally reaching this state, sometimes rather quickly reaching it and enjoying the playing of it tremendously. It's another thing to push himself to becoming like Segovia on the guitar or something like that. See, Rubinstein, the great pianist, is in the 80s now. And, I don't know if he still practices, but a few years ago I read a little article about him when someone says, do you still practice? And he said, 6 hours a day. And the woman said, well, why do you practice 6 hours a day, you know, at 80 years of age? Do you need this? He says, no. He says, I don't need it, but I got to do it. He says, sometimes when I'm doing it, I wonder, my wife is outside in the garden enjoying the sun, I'm inside pounding the piano. He said, but if I don't do it, he says, I got to do it. There's no question. He's undoubtedly addicted to this much practice. Now, undoubtedly, a man as great a musician as he is undoubtedly spins off during this time. He would be bored stiff if he didn't. I'm sure he can play. Now, whether when you see a virtuoso performance on a musical instrument or a virtuoso performance on the stage or anything like this, I also have a feeling that at these times, these people sometimes spin out. And they're literally performing out of their mind. What's that? It could happen. It could happen. And he performs over his head. Right. I'm not much into music very much, but years ago when older folks like myself were starting in with a little folk singing, and Pete Seeger was kind of the head guy around, and I spent some little time with him. I don't know him, but I spent a little time fairly close to him. And when he really gets into a performance, he's really out of it. That he can do things with that banjo I don't think he even believes. And that's the difference. I mean, you literally see people do impossible things. And what stops you from doing them is self-criticism. If you can let yourself alone, it just goes.
Is this spinning out somewhat synonymous with fantasizing or falling through doing different plays? I mean,
it could be. It could be. When Studs Terkel in his book Working describes the auto worker on their production line, he said, the only way I can make it is to let my mind go while I'm putting these wheels on the car, and then my day goes by and it's okay. Sometimes I feel even refreshed. But if I really think of the stupid things I'm doing for 8 hours a day, he says it's excruciating. I think many people on compulsive repetitive tasks make it that way, the same way that Papillon made it in solitary confinement. If he thought of his situation, he would have died. Most people did die when they were put into the kind of confinement he was put into. But he was able to let himself go. Now, this doesn't produce miracles for you. Maybe some of that just gets you through the day. But it does give you the strength to continue something that otherwise would be abhorrent. Human beings weren't designed to work for General Motors and make cars the way they do. But that's the way it works for thousands of people, or did up until recently. Now, if they can't do anything better, some of them will miss the job because at home they can't spin out. I got a feeling that that'll be the case on a repetitive job. It's like a headache, but you miss it if you don't have it. There's a question back there. I don't know. I don't think we ever achieve the maximum strength, and we fluctuate up and down, and probably we can feed it with other experiences, but I don't know if it's exactly like that. I just feel that a strong person probably has fluctuations in his strength, but his mean is above a weak person. But I think the more he can feed this thing, the more he can either gain more strength or maintain the strength he has. After all, very few of us in our lives are ever called upon to use our maximum potential strength. And if we have more strength, we probably use it in the imaginary area of our life more than the actual area. By that I mean in the enjoyment of things, in books, music, people, and other things, not just tangibly making money with it or getting position with it. I think that's a large component of this strength. It's just two people can have the same a life situation, and one person can just enjoy life a lot more than the other. And I think that I equate strength as correlating with that ability. Some people, for instance, are just never bored. They just never are, that's all. They just seem to always have something to do that they enjoy, or even when they're sitting around, they're not uncomfortable. I think that's a stronger person than somebody that says, oh gosh, I'm bored, I don't know what to do today, and this kind of thing. That's a person with very few options. He's looking around, he needs external reinforcement, he has no internal strength to provide this for him. This isn't miraculous. I mean, nobody's going to do miraculous things with it, but some people can. Yes. No, I haven't done anything about hard rock or anything like that. I don't know anything about that. I can't stand the noise. Yeah. I don't think you can really, in a helping situation, change a negative addict into a positive addict. There are times, however, in a helping situation, when you're dealing with someone, whether they're an addict or whatever their problem is, that if the so-called helping therapy type person, the therapist, will just sit down with the person and do nothing but sit down with them, it can be very beneficial. I used to have girls at the Ventura School that used to say, Dr. Glasser, I've got to see you. I've just got to see you. And so I'd make an appointment as soon as possible for them to come and see me, either in the corner of the room or in the office or someplace. And they'd come in, and I'd think, my goodness, this girl's really got something on her mind. You know, she's really going to say something. And she'd sit down and she wouldn't say anything. She'd just sit there a little bit and she'd talk maybe a little bit, or there wasn't anything. I was looking for this stupendous thing. Maybe she was going to confess a murder or something, like nothing. And then, so after 10 or 15 minutes, I'd say, well, okay. And she'd say, fine. She'd leave. And then I'd see her maybe a day or two later or a week later, and says, oh, that visit with you was just the greatest, she said. It was just so wonderful. Well, now I begin to think, years later, that what I did is I just let her be in the presence of someone she probably to some extent respected. I neither criticized her, I just let her be for a little bit. And some of these delinquent girls, because of the things they'd done, were highly self-critical of themselves, locked up and everything else. And I gave her a respite. And during that respite, she had a little feeling that maybe I can make it or something like that. And so she described this as so terribly important, whereas to me it was almost nothing. What's the big deal? And so I think that many of us, especially who work with delinquents and children who have a lot of personal inadequacy, and the kids in trouble, because I've done this, if we could think of this self-criticism thing that's driving them into this repetitive wrong behavior, just like a bad tennis player is being driven by self-criticism into worse and worse strokes. That if we just sit down with the kid as this tennis teacher does and say, okay, just let it be, this can be very positive. And after you sit with the kid a while, say, great, I'll see you next week. And the kid will say, well, what happened? Say, it's fine, I just want to be with you a little bit. That the kid will report next week, you know, that was the best session we had. That sometimes doing nothing is a very good thing. I'm not saying always. And I don't want people to get wrong that all psychotherapy means just sitting with somebody. But there are times when sometimes you just let things be, and it's very good. Yes. I've had a lot of people say reading did this for them and things like that. I think there's a lot of things which I would classify, I didn't want to talk about it, but I would classify as what I call neutral addictions. They don't really cause you to spin out very much, but they're highly enjoyable and you give you a sense of relaxation and things like that, which are probably very good for you, but aren't in this other category. And studying could be that way too, but studying has a highly self-critical element to it. You're usually studying for a test or for a paper or for something, and you're worried about what you're going to get on it. So it's very hard to achieve this in studying, unless it's self-motivated study on your own, which is pretty rare. It happens, but pretty rare. Some people describe if they learned a foreign language on their own in the process, they felt kind of free, but. I don't classify those as quite the same, and I don't really know where to put them. I just that's all I can say. Way in the back, yes. Well, that's a very difficult thing to define. I only take it from other people. It's the state of feeling that your mind is alone on its own. It's like letting your brain go wherever it wants to go without you controlling it or directing it for a period of time. Letting it be by itself. A very difficult state to achieve, but that is the PA state. Leaving your mind alone, out of your head, spinning out. There's a lot of different terms for it. I'm going to gather together all the terms because different people write different ways, but spinning out is the most graphic to me because it's not only alone, but it's kind of churning, but it's doing its own thing. And you're not directing it, and it's growing in the process. I think it's actually forming new pathways in the process. It's not unconscious. It's not being unconscious, but it's an altered state of consciousness. I think that the transcendental meditation material describes this altered state, this third state or fourth state, quite accurately as a different state of consciousness. It could be all of those things. Some people describe it exactly as you say. They get a feeling that everything is one, a total feeling of congruence. I hesitate to describe something. I've experienced it, and to me, it's like being in two states at the same time. I'm here doing my thing, and my mind is off there, and we're together and we're separate, and I'm sometimes surprised. Sometimes when I'm working on something I'm writing, and I start to just spin out then, and then something comes to my mind, and I'm surprised where it came from. It didn't directly cause it to come, it just came. Well, I think I was momentarily in that state, and here it was. Tip of your tongue forgetting is another example of that, that you have to relax your mind for it to come. If you start working on that remembrance, it'll never come, but you forget it, and then a moment later it just flashes right in your mind like a big neon sign, and you blurt out the name or something like that. Those are little indications of it, but in its real condition, when you really get into it, it's just much more of that. I think people can recall some of the things, but sometimes not. They just recall the state. They don't recall anything. It's not necessary to recall it. But some people can. I think like dreams, if you really work at remembering dreams, you can. Dreams are another state. They're not quite the same. They're another state. They're evidently very essential too, but it's not quite the same thing. Maybe one more question, yeah. The question is, do I relate this to receiving or sending or ESP or anything like that? The answer is I don't. It's not that it can't be, but I personally don't believe in that stuff. I do believe that people can get on the same wavelength of thought, and I do believe that there's lots of times I know what another person is thinking, but I think I do that through statistics. I think he's probably thinking that rather than he actually sends a thought to me. I don't believe any of these guys like Dunninger. That's all tricks. I mean, I don't believe any of that stuff. There is a whole science of that kind of a thing. This astronaut is into it. Mitchell, he's into it, called noetics and things like that. But Mitchell got involved with some Israeli guy named Yuri Geller. And Mitchell was so steamed up. I had dinner with him once. He says, "This guy is a true miracle man." And I told him, "You know, you're being had." And he, But he was had, you know. Geller undid metal. He said, "Why, he took this ring of my girlfriend in front of my very eyes. The ring undid itself." Now, that's mind was bending metal. And I told him the old story from Damon Runyon. He said, "What do you think about it?" In Guys and Dolls, they asked Sky Masterson, the hero of Guys and Dolls, "Sky, did you ever have a father?" And he says, "Well," he says, "not really. I was born, but," he says, "my dad was never around." He says, "But when I was about 20-some years old, I met my dad one day on Broadway, walking..."